Hello and welcome back to another episode of the Wonder Podcast, the podcast where we break down and review films all in one big, long, unbroken take. I'm Austin Archer, and with me, as always, is my childhood next-door neighbor and lifelong best friend,
Kramer England.
All right. Today we are talking about Zach Cregger's sophomore effort, Weapons.
Yes.
Yeah, as always on the show, or as more recently we've been doing, we will talk for the first 10 minutes or so spoiler free. So no spoilers. If you don't want to know any spoilers, we'll talk for a little, just our general thoughts about the film, and then we'll get into more specifics, but we will let you know when that happens. Kramer, just what are your general thoughts on Weapons?
General thoughts. Okay, I'm going to start. I'm kind of two minds of this. I'm going to start with the negative.
Okay.
The negative is that this movie does not really hold up to scrutiny in many, many ways. Mm. There are many things about this movie when you break it down or when you think about it a little bit more, there's not really an answer. There's not a clear answer, or it's a really dumb answer. Mm. And it's kind of, it can be really frustrating when you think about it in certain scenes when you think about them.
Yeah.
So overall, like, my negative aspect is like, okay, there's a lot that does not hold up in certain ways for this movie. Now, on the other hand, I don't care about that. I had a ton of fun in this movie.
Yeah.
Like, I was engaged the entire time.
Yeah.
Absolutely the entire time. I was totally in it, and I wanted to know what happened next.
Yeah.
So, like every time I think about something, it frustrates me, but then I'm like, man, it was just like so much fun. Like, it was done so well, executed so well. And this is the thing, like, the most important thing about movies, keep people entertained. Mm-hmm. And that's what this movie did. Like, I was in it the whole time. I was engaged the whole time. I loved the characters. It was done like there were some things that, you know, I mean, it was scary, but it was more funny than it was scary, I think. But it added some really interesting things. It didn't really lean on tropes that much. It added a lot of really interesting things. So I really love the movie. I think overall, this is another kind of negative thing that isn't really negative. It's the setup and the mystery is way more interesting than the actual reveal, which we will get into. But again, the reveal is good enough. And I had a ton of fun with it. And there is a lot of deep context to all of this that you can read this film in many, many different ways, which Zach Cregger has said is kind of what he wants, which is good. If that's what he wants, that's kind of what it is. But then it's also a little hard to narrow it down to what he's trying to say. But again, it was so much fun. Like, I had a ball and I loved being there, and my whole theater had a great time too. So what were your thoughts?
I feel similarly. My theater, I think, had a blast during this movie. My theater was responding better to this movie than my theater was to The Naked Gun.
Oh, really?
I felt like the laughs, like the collective moments of gasping, the collective moments of, oh my God, like the collective moments where everyone like collectively went, oh no, or something like that, or laughed together, were more unified than what I was expecting out of The Naked Gun. I thought that like a lot of times The Naked Gun, I would laugh out loud at something and I'd be like, oh, I was one of the only people that laughed at that. And then I would feel kind of insecure, but my audience was all on the same page. I thought this movie was a ton of fun. I always felt taken care of by Zach Cregger's direction, by the way that he worked with his cinematographer, by the actors, by the writing. I didn't feel like I had to, like, I wasn't taken out of it while I was watching it by things that were so noticeably problematic or such big plot holes that I was like, I can't get over that. I agree with you that when I go through with a fine-toothed comb and look for inconsistencies or things that maybe don't hold up to scrutiny, I can find those things. And I was trying to look for them, especially when the movie ended, because my first thought was like, I don't know what I'm going to dock points for. Cause I just was like, I just enjoyed that so much.
Right.
And so I was like, what will I dock points for? And then as I was thinking, I was like, yeah, there are definitely some plot contrivances that I could be nitpicky about if I wanted to. But like you said, they didn't ruin my experience of watching the movie. They didn't get, like, I felt so taken care of by the competent filmmaking that, and I think that, like, there's sort of a world in cinema where, like, a plot hole is okay with me if you can pull it off. It's kind of like what you, what can you get away with, you know? And it's sort of like, if you can get away with contrived writing where, like, there's something that happens in a plot where I can go, well, why wouldn't somebody have noticed this or that thing?
Right.
But you, but you can make the movie engaging enough that I don't really care. Then it's like, okay, great. You know, some of the most classic movies that I grew up with are full of things like that, where can ask questions all day long about, like, what is the specific nature of Doc Brown and Marty McFly's relationship? Why are they best friends? Or you can just be like, this movie rules. And it's like, you know, and I think sometimes in the modern era where everybody's got a movie podcast and where everybody's got a Letterboxd account and where everybody is contributing to audience reviews on Rotten Tomatoes, we are, like, the scrutiny that we subject modern films to is, it's really hard for most movies throughout the history of cinema to stand up to that level of scrutiny. So you're right. There are things that can be pointed at in this film, but as an experience and as, like, a ride at the cinema, like, I was laughing when I think the director wanted me to laugh. I was scared when I think he wanted me to be scared. I was leaning forward in my seat, eager to learn each new piece of the mystery. I liked the construction and the structure of the script, and I felt like it wasn't just gimmicky. I've heard people comparing it to, like, Paul Thomas Anderson, or that, like, that he was doing a riff on some of these other kind of, like, almost anthology movies where they over, you know, interlap, like Crash or something like that. But I was like, I don't even think that, I think just because he's doing that structure doesn't mean that he is definitely homaging anything. And also, it's not a problem if he is, but I felt like you said, like, this movie's got one of the best premises of any movie this year, of any horror thriller movie I've seen in a long time.
Yes.
To be honest. And it's why one of my favorite things about this movie was the marketing campaign for it. The premise is so good that they knew we can market this on the premise alone.
Yeah.
It's interesting watching the film. It's like the first 5 minutes of the film are mostly the trailer. And so, so, and I was watching that going, oh, this is really interesting because I've already seen all of this, which means the rest of the movie is all of the stuff I haven't seen, which is really exciting. Yeah. And you're right. Like if I wanted to get nitpicky about it, I could say maybe I was hoping for a little bit more of a spectacular answer to the kind of fundamental question at the core premise of the film. Maybe I was hoping for something a little more mind-blowing or a little more weird or unexpected. But what I got certainly wasn't like a letdown. I definitely was like, no, this all works, I think. And I felt pretty satisfied by the conclusion. So
And that's, it was good enough. Like, okay, like I can get on board with this. It wasn't it wasn't something that was disappointing. But then also, again, you have such a big premise. It was kind of like, okay, it's that. And they go forward with it. They push with it, which is good. But
right. And I don't, you know, it's like, for the spoiler-free section of this video, I want to give people as little as possible, because this is a movie where I think the less you know, the better going into it.
It is.
I think, you know, the marketing was intentional about withholding information.
Yeah.
And so should we be, to say, if you have not seen it yet, this is us both saying we enjoyed it and it's worth the cost of a movie ticket and go find out for yourself.
Yeah. It was, I mean, it was a fun theater experience. Like, it's not as scary as the marketing is making it out to be.
But there were a few scenes.
Oh, there were. I'm not saying it's not scary.
Yeah.
But it's not like a straight horror where it's from beginning to end. There are, like, it's a horror comedy, but not even a horror. Like, it's not like Shaun of the Dead, where that's more comedy than horror.
It's very
more horror than comedy, but.
it's very genre fluent. It's like, it's like,
I like that word.
It's like a drama sometimes. I mean, it's just like a straight up, like, you know, it's like there is a subgenre of mystery film that's just like a missing person film. And it's a missing person mystery film.
It is an ensemble. Like
it's an ensemble film.
We're not following one story. We're following multiple, which also made it very interesting and kept your. But yeah, I don't want to say too much because I agree. Like, but this is the thing. The marketing is going to tell you it's a horror movie, which is, I think, was a good idea because it overall is probably that is the biggest genre that it is. But they intentionally excluded a few things that we'll talk about that I thought was kind of like, okay, that was, I understand why they did that. But anyway, go see it for yourself and see what you think because it's a great time.
Absolutely. That'll do it for our spoiler-free section. Okay, if you're still watching, that means you're watching the full review, and here comes the spoilers, okay? So so if you just want the spoiler-free one, we've got a shorter video that's just that one. But so weapons. It begins with the narration that you hear if you've watched the trailer of this film.
Right.
Like, from the start of the film, if you've watched the trailer, you know, even if you've seen a poster for this film, it just kind of says, one day in this town, 17 kids from this classroom disappeared at 2:17 in the morning.
Yeah.
And they
all opened their doors. They walked out and they ran away and they were and they never came back.
Yeah.
That's what it says.
And now this is I've watched a few people online talk about this.
Me
that
too.
Like the premise, this tagline, they left and they never came back, is sort of fundamentally lying to the audience because it's like, well, no, like they were gone for a month and a half, maybe like 6 weeks. And what we've come to find out, spoilers, is they do come back or in some form.
They come back physically.
Yeah.
Yeah. And the thing that I've heard, which is, I imagine it's what you've heard as well, is they did not come back mentally. And that's what they're referring to.
And the ending has a line that seems to suggest maybe like it's, you know, but I've heard some people that said that they felt lied to by that marketing. And I was like, I don't really see it as a deceit. Like, to me, it's like, this is the story of the time all of these kids left their homes and didn't come home.
Yeah.
And what you could say is they didn't come home for a while, for so long that it felt like they were never coming home.
Yes.
And this is the story of like what happened in between the time that they left and the time that they were found.
Yeah.
And they, you know, it's like they didn't come back. They didn't they didn't return home. They were found. And then mentally and emotionally, many of them maybe never will fully return.
And that didn't bother me. Yeah. Like I get it, but I also like, what are they going to say? They didn't come back until a month and a half later. And then you're like, okay, now I'm expecting to know that they're all fine. You don't, you want to leave that mystery. I think I was not bothered by that line of they did not come back.
Neither was
because of the emotional or, you know, mental part of it. The thing that this is probably the thing that bothers me the most. Or one of the things that bothers me the most. So in the trailers, they say that all the kids left and they never came back. But that is not true. There is one kid who is still there. There's only one who showed up to class that day. His name is Alex.
Yeah.
And to me, I was like, that seems to be very, very intentional for the marketing. Because the rest of the trailers, all the trailers did this. They say none of the kids come back. And then all the parents are mad at the teacher who played by Julia Garner. Is that her name? Right.
Yeah.
Which she did a fantastic job.
Yeah.
But all the trailers make it look like all the parents are mad at her, which makes me think, what would she have to do with it? She was the only one there. How's that going on? But the marketing never said that one kid came back because one kid never left. Yeah.
Yeah.
In my mind, it's like, well, that kid had something to do with it.
Yeah.
Why is he the only one? Like, it bothers me because like, when you think about it, you're like, well, yeah, obviously he would have something to do with it, which in the end he did.
I feel like I saw trailers that said one kid
Really? I never saw any. I didn't.
I feel like any. I did, but I might be misremembering that. But I feel like,
and I'll have to look back and see it.
Which... I feel like in the theater, I wasn't surprised that there was one kid. I was like, oh yeah, I remember that from the trailer, but I might be misremembering. Yeah. I don't know. But either way, like here's the thing about like mystery box movies or TV shows that have a great central question to them. Lost. What is this island? What's going on here? Right. You know, one of my favorite shows, The Leftovers, where it's like, the central question of the show is like, one day, 14 million people all around the world disappeared. Right. Just go boop, and they bloop out of existence. And the central question of the show is, where'd they go? What happened? Were they abducted by aliens? Was it the rapture?
Yeah.
Was it like, did they get shot into an alternate parallel universe? Right. What? And it's like, the thing about mystery box shows is a lot of times, there is no answer that's ever going to fully satisfy your craving for like, what could the answer be?
Right.
And I think that I kind of look at this thing and it's like, I think some people wanted a bigger or weirder or grander or even maybe to have the movie end and not have the question answered.
Right.
To leave the mystery open and leave it feeling unresolved or something. I think that it's like at any time a storyteller imbues their story with a central question that's this interesting, it's almost going to be impossible for them to provide an answer to the question that everyone finds fully satisfying. And that's why I still look at this and go, I'm good with the answer. I'm good with it. It's definitely not an answer that makes me go like, oh, bummer. It's that.
I know. Yeah.
You know, like,
yeah, I feel the same way, because like I was talking to my friend at work about it. We had a whole discussion about it. And it's like, okay, well, what else could you do? Could you do aliens? And it's like, well, that might be a little really weird. Like, you'd have to change a lot. Or is it a government conspiracy? Like, okay, that also changes things a little bit.
I definitely from the marketing, I thought sure it was going to be government something. I thought it was going to be programming in the water. TV,
yes.
Something. Yeah. And that they were taking these kids and they're going to turn them into soldiers or something.
Right. Like, totally. Sure. And that in some world, that could be what this movie is about. Mm-hmm. And just as you're like, as we're talking about, I'm like, well, I don't know if I would be more satisfied with any of those. You really can't please everyone in this case.
Right.
And the thing that I appreciate about this movie is that Zach Cregger was just like, this is what it is, and I'm going to keep going with it. Like, the reveal happens like pretty much at the midpoint, or at least you kind of get an idea at the midpoint of what it is. So the rest of the movie is not about the reveal, which I think was very, very smart. Mm-hmm. The rest of it is just kind of like, here, this is what it was. It's a witch, and it's magic. It's black magic, right? And now it's like, okay, I'm going to keep going with this and show you what she's doing to kind of keep furthering her plan, which I think was why I liked it.
Yeah.
Because most of the time when you have a mystery, you reveal it in the third act, and then the third act is wrapping it up, and then you kind of don't have time to process it.
But
with this being at the midpoint, it's like, okay, let's have some fun with it and let's push this to where it ultimately goes. So yeah, that's why I liked it.
Don't worry about what it is anymore. It's crazy Aunt Gladys. Like, it's that's what it is. And now we got to like watch the rest of the movie knowing that crazy Aunt Gladys is out there doing spells.
Yeah.
And that, you know, but it's like, it's like sort of exactly. It's like, rather than having it be the very end of the movie and then you have to decide whether or not you're satisfied with the answer.
Yeah.
It's like, this is the answer. And now let's watch A, how she accomplished it, and B, what, you know, how it resolves.
Right.
And I like that. But so we get this narration at the beginning of the movie that was in the trailer. It's like a little girl that's like narrating this thing that happened in her town.
We never know who it is.
Never know who this is, but she's just talking about how, you know, lots of people died in sad ways. And I liked how she said, like, they don't talk about it a lot because the police are kind of embarrassed that they weren't able to solve it.
Yeah.
And I like that little detail, because one of the many little plot contrivances that was in my head in this movie was like, in the modern era, like, a plot device in this movie is that there are two houses that had Ring cam footage of their kids leaving, and it's Josh Brolin and it's this other house where Justin Long has like a cameo, and they have Ring cam footage of their kids leaving. And I was like, if this movie takes place in today's day and age, 90% of those houses have ring cams. Like, yes, it's not, yeah, just two of them. Like, and if, yeah, not all the kids' houses, like, all, there are going to be multiple houses in this neighborhood,
yeah,
that have, yeah, that have cameras angles of these kids running. And it's going to be enough evidence that the police would be able to say all the kids are running in the same way, which, yes, means something.
Yes.
And they're all, and we could actually track geographically where they're running. We could, like, yeah, make, we, they should be able to pinpoint where they're running to, but, right, so the movie can happen. The movie tells us that only two ring cams caught this, well, happening. And I'm like, you know, but, yes, I'm like, sure.
Yes.
You know what? And then also, it, like, later on when we have the police examine, Alex's house, I was just kind of, mm-hmm, like, you're telling me they go over to the only kid who survives house, and, yeah, Aunt Gladys is who they meet, and they're like, nothing fishy here. I'm just kind of, yep, like,
perfectly, like, normal woman.
Yeah, I'm just like, and she's telling them that the dad had a stroke and,
yeah,
is unable to talk, and there's no one at the school who's like, I've met that guy before, he can definitely talk.
The, you know, principal, like, says that.
Right.
The principal,
right,
says, like, I've met his parents, like, what's, right, going on with them? So, yes, I agree. Yes.
Right. So there were definitely some, like, plot contrivances where, yes, it was like, this needs to happen this way in order for the movie to happen. And you could maybe chalk it up to, like, maybe part of her magic is casting a spell on the police officers that come.
Yeah.
Who knows?
I've heard that too. Yeah. And I think I've heard as well that this is a commentary, or I kind of thought, like, well, this is a commentary on the police, maybe not doing a good enough job or not looking into things as much as they should, which I can see, but I also am like, that's just a little too much. If it's anything, it's got to be the witch has some sort of, you know, grasp on them.
Well, my girlfriend noticed something that I didn't notice at all, and she was like, oh, well, I thought it was a fairly obvious allegory about abuse and about how abuse gets, right, covered up. And I was like, right, oh, right, I did. And so there's that too, where it's like,
yes,
even in cases where there's very clearly harm being done to a child at home, there's, right, all this red tape that, like, teachers and authority figures have to navigate in order to step in and do something.
Yeah.
So it's really hard to build a case of, like, intervening and getting child, yeah, protective services involved sometimes. Right. And I could see that being the thing where it's like, even though there's a lot of,
yeah,
red flags, there are also a lot of bureaucratic,
yeah, it's a lot of red tape,
a lot of red things in the way of,
yeah,
having these authority figures be able to step in definitively and do something. Like, yeah, from early on, Julia Garner, who is trying to get close to this kid, is told by her superiors at the school, don't talk to him. Don't, yeah, you know, and she feels like something's off, and she feels like she wants to talk to Alex, but she's told by everyone, leave the kid alone.
Yeah.
And I think that could be an interesting metaphor for, like, if there is a kid who has a parent who's struggling with alcoholism at home, and there's abuse happening at home, and a teacher notices something, right, but it's like, right, at what point am I authorized to step in and say something? At what, right, point am I authorized to try to pull the kid away for a private chat? When is that inappropriate? When is that appropriate? And I think the same thing can happen with all the way up to the level of the police.
Right.
And I think that's an interesting commentary that.
Yes. I yeah, it does. It does. Yeah. And again, Zach Cregger is saying you can interpret this however many ways you want. I think, yeah, that is a very valid interpretation. I do think, though, again, these are the nitpicks that are kind of annoying, but it wasn't, if that is what he's saying, it wasn't handled in the way that it could, but he's handling a lot of things. So it's, right, like, okay, that's fine. Like, I can definitely see that, many different commentaries about that. Right. But anyway, so that is that you definitely have to make a big jump with, and later on in the film we see that all the kids run down the middle of the street to, right, this house,
yeah,
and I'm like, okay, there's way more people that would have ring
that's doorbells. Exactly, like, it's like somebody would have caught this on camera, yes, happening, somebody, yes, like, yeah, somebody would have been awake, like, at 2:17 in the morning, like, somebody would have been awake watching TV and, like, looked out their window and been like, there's 20, yeah, kids running down the street,
yeah,
at 2 o'clock in the morning, you know?
Yeah.
So you just sort of have to, like, yeah, go with a, yeah, lot
That's a big jump, and I was able to make it in the movie.
Well, and again, it's like the imagery sells it. You know, like it's a great image. These kids running through the dark in their pajamas with their arms spread out. I mean, it's a
it is striking.
From the jump, when I first saw like the very first teaser for this movie, I was like, okay, that's you got me. Like, that's interesting.
Yeah. Like, why are they running like that? What is it that, which it's never explained why they're running like that. Which is fine. I thought, again, that's one thing that's like, yeah, cool. Just leave it up to your imagination of what it is. But
well, and he, Josh Brolin's character kind of says like, they almost look like a heat seeking missile. Like,
You know, they do look like a plane too. Like, So I saw a few things that Zach Cregger in the script said he modeled it after a Vietnam picture of a young girl who's naked and doused in,
I've seen that photo,
napalm. Yeah. And she has her hands out, which is like very terrifying. Right. Mm-hmm. And so that's what he put in the script. That's what he wanted. But he's also, you know, he's saying you can leave it up to interpretation. I see it almost as a plane, right? They're like heat seeking missile, or they're kind of like kids just running like a plane, or they can't move anything except for their torso and their legs, you know? So either way, it's a very striking image, whatever it grabs your attention.
Yeah. And it gets you, I think stuff like that keeps you focused on the story being told rather than thinking your brain spiraling and going, how's no one seeing it? You know, it's like it's the imagery, the cinematography, the storytelling is engaging enough from moment to moment that you're willing to just go along with it, which is where I'm like, you know, like I think I've talked to some people who just, I think they just wanted more out of this movie based off the marketing. They just wanted it to be grander or weirder or more revolutionary. And I'm like, sometimes a movie that just does what it's trying to do well is good enough, you know? And anyway, so the structure of this film is we're watching one character at a time and we're getting basically these different vignettes that sometimes overlap with each other, but we're getting one point of view at a time. And we start with Justine Gandy, who is the teacher, and she's played by Julia Garner. So we see this sort of parent teacher meeting where they're trying to talk to the parents who are grieving their kids who are lost. And we see that the parents are very upset with Justine Gandy, and some parents think that she has something to do with the disappearance. And it makes sense that they would, that they'd be like, why is it only your classroom?
Yeah. Josh Brolin is kind of leading that charge. He gets up and he says, I want her to speak. Why is it that, he's the one who's really getting all the parents riled up, which is totally understandable why a parent would be upset with a teacher.
Yeah. And the parents wind up getting so mad that she has to get like ushered out of the school. Yeah. And then, you know, that night she goes to the liquor store and we kind of find out this, I mean, what I like about this movie too, is that the characters are flawed and messy. You know, I really just found the characters to be really interesting, that even though Justine is completely innocent when it comes to the disappearance of these kids, Justine's got a lot going on in her life. She's an active alcoholic who really does seem to care about her job, but who also copes with probably, you know, financial insecurity and her sort of middling love life through substance abuse.
Yeah.
And, she, you know, she goes out and gets drunk, and while she's at home drinking, people are knocking on her door and she's looking out the window, and then somebody comes by and they paint witch on her car, which winds up being a nice bit of foreshadowing.
Yes.
But she's, you know, she's trying to get the police to do something about it. She's also been sort of given a leave of absence by the school. They took her one remaining student, Alex, and they put him in another class, and her principal, Bennett, played by Benedict Wan, tells her just go home and just, you know,
just let this all blow over. But and this again, like, she was such an interesting character, and the way that they did this, right, she goes into the liquor store, this druggy guy tries to open the door for her and he's like, hey, I'm just trying to get some bus money, which he shows up later. It was great to kind of weave all of these stories because I was like, why is this druggy doing that? And then he shows up later. Anyway, we get this great character development of her showing her substance abuse. And I think there is a commentary on substance abuse that we'll get into,
you know, for later, sure. Absolutely.
Which I thought was great. But she's, when she's talking to the principal, Benedict Wong, he's like, it's a great way to just reveal her character, because she's like, I want to know how Alex is. And he's like, listen, that would be inappropriate. You're already under scrutiny for being inappropriate before. They say it in a much better way than that. It's revealed much better, but
that she drove a student home once whose parents left her, and she like hugged a student who was crying and she got in, you know, where she's like, what am I supposed to do? Just be like a robot with no emotions. And I see these kids crying. I'm not, you know, and it's like,
and she was inappropriate for the appropriate reason.
Right.
And so like, I was like, okay, she's an alcoholic. She really does care about her job and her kids.
Yeah.
But she also cares a little too much to a fault.
Yeah.
And then this comes up later. I think after she talks to Benedict Wong, I think she sees where Alex is going, but then I think she meets up with
Han Solo.
Han Solo, yeah.
Well, yeah, because so she's talking to another cop about her car that was vandalized.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
And while she's doing that, she sees Alden Ehrenreich, and he waves to her, and then we cut to that later that night at a bar, and he shows up and meets her at the bar. And they have this sort of, it's pretty clear that they have a romantic past, but that he's sort of seeing someone else, and that he also is trying not to drink, and she's trying to get him to drink.
Yeah.
And we do this sort of smash cut to them waking up the next morning in her bedroom, and it's clear that she got him to drink and to hook up with her and stuff. And again, it's like it's showing the messiness of her life too.
Yes.
It's like, well, none of this is evidence that she kidnapped a bunch of kids, but it's definitely like,
I mean, pretty quickly, I mean, as far as I was concerned, I was like, she has nothing to do with it. And they kind of make it clear that she has nothing to do with it as far as what's going on. But I did love this bar scene between her and Alden Ehrenreich, whose name is Paul. And he has a bandage on his finger, and you can tell he's like there, but he doesn't really want to be there.
Right.
But you can tell that she is like, she's trying to cope. You know, she's drinking a lot. She's being very, you know, flirtatious with him. And she's like, you know, whoever he's dating, I can't remember her name. Does she know you're here? And he's like, well, we're kind of off right now. And she was like, she gets really excited.
Yeah.
But you can tell also that she is very clingy. Like she again, she cares so much about these kids, but she's also probably steps over the line in a relationship.
Yeah.
She was just such a really fleshed out character that I was very interested in her the entire time because of her flaws.
I felt like all of the characters in this movie, for the most part, had really interesting internal lives that were like developed, that it felt like they existed before the movie began.
Yes.
And they had, you know, and it felt that way without having to do too much heavy-handed writing, which I just think is the sign of good writing, good direction, and good acting, that the characters felt like real people.
Absolutely.
But I think, as her storyline progresses and as we stay with her, she starts to, against the advisement of Benedict Wong, she starts to sort of follow Alex home. And she's just interested in what's going on with this kid. And we see she's sort of watching him walk down the street toward his house. And we see this just the very interesting imagery of like the front door of his house opens up and it's like pitch black inside the house.
Yeah.
And he walks in, and there's just something even about the way the door opens and the way he walks in that just feels off.
It does feel off. It's off-putting.
It's interesting to be able to do something as simple as like the way a door opens.
Yeah.
That in a movie you can go like, that's
because the door opens multiple times throughout the movie, and it's the same way, and it gives you the same feeling of like, there's something off about that house.
Yeah.
Something off going on in there.
Yeah. So she tries to go up and knock on the door. She decides, I'm going to go up there and I'm going to talk to the parents and just say, hey, listen, I just want to talk to Alex.
Yeah.
Nobody answers the door. Then she notices that there's newspaper all over the windows. Mm-hmm. You know, this is like, when you're watching as a viewer, this is when you're starting to go like, oh, geez, like something's wrong. The vibes are just not good. And she walks around the back of this house, and she's looking through a crack in the
newspapers.
And as she's looking around, she sees the silhouettes of two people sitting on a couch. And it's like, really, really scary. Creepy jump scare. But what's even creepier is she goes back and looks back in, and they're still just sitting there.
Yeah.
And they haven't moved or responded to her, you know, so she just backs away and she goes, sorry, I'm sorry. I, you know, and then she just leaves. And what, you know, she winds up going back and like like watching Alex again.
Well, yeah, I think she, I think she goes back to her apartment. She drinks again.
Right.
She's stumbling. Like you can tell she is totally hammered and she can barely turn off the light. She sleeps. And then she has, we have the same shot as the opening shot where she is, she's going into the school, but it's all dark. Her she's having a nightmare. And she walks into her classroom and all the kids are there with their heads down. And this was in the marketing too. This is a creepy shot.
Yeah.
And Alex, it was Alex, right?
Alex, yeah.
He lifts up his head and he's got like, he looks like the Joker.
Yeah.
I mean, he's got, you know, like looks like clown makeup on. He kind of just smiles at her.
Which we find out is relevant. I like all this stuff where early on you're like, what is going on there?
What is happening?
Yeah.
And she wakes up. She's scared and she wakes up. And then she sees a woman in her ceiling that's kind of like
looks like a clown.
And she's like, she's moving strangely and she screams and we see her for a long time. This was a terrifying jump scare.
Yeah. I liked how much Aunt Gladys feels like Pennywise through the first half of this film. It was very, I was like, oh, this is like very Stephen King It vibes.
It is.
We've got this, like all this, even though the kid had clown makeup on in the classroom, I wasn't expecting a full-on clown to be on her ceiling.
I wasn't either. Woke up.
And that definitely had me going like, is that just a weird dream thing or does that mean something?
Yeah.
But, yeah.
And it is funny because you can tell that it's not a clown.
Yeah.
Like it's not a clown. It's just a person who looks like a clown, which we find out later. But that was like, it was very scary. And it was a big jump scare. And I also wonder like why is Gladys doing this to Justine?
Right.
This is kind of when the nitpicks come in. Like, what is it that she's doing? Why doesn't she just let
her? Is she, you know, like, could it just be that like when you are entangled in the dark magic of this witch, you like without knowing it, she's been imprinted on somehow.
Right. Or like. Yeah, who knows what it is? Never talked about. But anyway, I think after this, she goes back to Alex's house in the evening.
Now, this was genuinely, this sequence was, I think, for me, the scariest moment of the entire movie.
Really?
And I thought it was like, it was one of those things where I just was like, that's really smart horror filmmaking.
Yeah.
Because she's basically like, watching this house. She watches Alex once again, like walk into the house, and then she's just waiting outside the house. And then we cut to, it's like a smash cut, and she's asleep at night in her car outside of their house.
And she's drinking.
She's been drinking. Yeah. She pours some vodka into like which is a move I used to do all the time back when I used to drink. Really? I used to always get a big gulp from 7-Eleven. And so there's a lot of stuff where I was like, boy, it takes me back. But she passes out in her car, and while she's asleep, the camera is showing us the front door of the house through her windshield, and we see the front door do that weird. It opens in the same weird way, but now somebody comes out, and this what I love scene like I get chills talking about right now.
Yeah,
because I love scenes in horror movies that aren't just a jump scare, but it's prolonged, and the movie doesn't let you off the hook. So we have to watch this character like walk out of the front door and walk all the way down the sidewalk, like, and walk toward her car.
And they're walking very strangely.
Yeah, she's like walking like this. It's this really weird walk that she's doing.
Yeah,
and then she gets all the way up to the windshield, and then we change the camera to looking through the driver's side window, and she walks up to the driver's side window, and everyone in my theater was like, oh geez, no, and it looks like she's maybe gonna like punch through the window and like stab Justine, but instead she just turns and walks away, and the audience released. Everyone was like, oh phew. But then the shot doesn't stop.
No.
And then after like 3 or 4 seconds, you hear the back door open up. Yeah. And when that happened, I just went, oh no. And everyone in the theater was just like, no, you know, cause like, and this is to me, this is like great horror filmmaking where it's like, he let us off the hook And then he gives us this sound effect of the back door opening. Yeah. And we have to sit there and we can't see what's going on in the back seat. Can hear someone like getting into the car behind her. And then you just see this hand reach up into the frame with scissors. Yeah. And you're just like,
you're like,
And I like how long. It is. Like, I like how
you can hear the scissors too. Like, you know, okay, she's got scissors. Because you can hear them kind of like chomping open, you know, open and close, and they've got that sound effect. But the hands come forward with the scissors, and then it just cuts off a piece of her hair.
Yeah.
And then that's it.
And that's the end of Justine's.
Yeah, it ends there. I do have to say, though, I get why the witch cut her hair, but why did she not just kill her?
Yeah, good point. You know, who knows?
And that's kind of, I'm maybe kind of like...
Maybe it's too messy to like get her out of her car. I don't know.
That's the only thing that I could think of is like it would draw attention. But also she could just have the zombie parents drive the car away. And
yeah.
But again, that's kind of like, okay, whatever. I was totally engaged this whole time. I was freaked out. So
yeah.
Anyway, it reminded me.
It reminded me of that scene in Scream when Neve Campbell locks herself in a Jeep and the killer is like on one side of her. Then he like pops up on the other side and she's looking around and she's got a phone and she's trying to make a phone call. And behind her, the trunk opens up, you know,
you don't see
him get in, but you just know that like, and she doesn't hear it. And it's like, I love stuff like that. It's just keeping you in that.
Well, and I didn't think about that until after. Because it's a mystery. We don't know why. So, but it did further the mystery and it added so much like tension. Like it was just like, oh my gosh, this is so scary.
Yeah. And then this is our first where we're like, we've only been with Justine this far.
Yeah.
And we do a hard, we're out on Justine and we go in on Archer. And immediately I looked at my girlfriend. I was like, eh?
I thought of that too. I actually thought, oh, Austin, he's going to like this.
Yeah. I was like, Archer. So Josh Brolin is a guy named Archer.
Yes.
And his son is one of the boys, Matthew. His son, Matthew, is one of the boys that went missing. And, and so basically we follow Josh Brolin's character and we get to see that parent-teacher conference again from his perspective. And we actually, it's like when we were looking at Justine, we just sort of hear him behind her, but now we actually get to see him. But I did like that we start with him, that he's sleeping in his son's bed and he's obviously
going through a lot.
Yeah.
I
really liked his storyline and I really liked his character, that the way he was grieving and what it was doing to his marriage. And
I love Josh Brolin. I think he's awesome. He was in, side note, he was sleeping in Batman sheets, which he was really campaigning to get Batman in the Zack Snyder. He wanted to be Batman. And I was like, you know what? Josh Brolin would be an amazing old Batman. Like once I heard that, I was like, please have him get cast, but he wasn't. Probably a good thing. Anyway, I love Josh Brolin. His character was also very, very intriguing and very fleshed out.
Well, and speaking of casting, it's like it's been publicized a lot that this was supposed to be Pedro Pascal. And A, I think Pedro Pascal is in too many movies right now. And B, I genuinely think that they dodged a bullet. I think that Josh Brolin is not that Pedro Pascal would have been bad. Right. I think Josh Brolin is so much more well suited to this character than Pedro Pascal.
Yeah, I think Pedro Pascal, I love Pedro Pascal, but I think he is, like you said, there's probably just too many movies. I think the movie would have been a little more focused on him than the story as a whole.
Yeah.
And I think Josh Brolin is just, he's just such a, I mean, they're very similar actors in many ways, but I do think as well, like Josh Brolin just nails this role and he is like, I can see Pedro Pascal in it, but I think I like Josh Brolin for this role a little better. I don't know if I'd say dodged a bullet because it would have been fine.
Yeah. It's not like he would have,
I know what you mean.
Yeah. I think the kind of character that Archer is, that he's sort of this, you know, kind of like almost like conservative Americana truck driving, like tough guy.
He's a construction worker.
And he's a construction worker. And one of his things is that he regrets never saying I love you to his son.
Yeah.
And he talks about that in his storyline and that he's got this tough, rough exterior.
Yeah.
And that's why this is, you know, it's so hard for him. And I think that that's just a role that's more well suited to Josh Brolin's type than to Pedro. I think Pedro Pascal is just a softer energy.
I agree.
Than Brolin.
Yeah.
And it's interesting to see a guy like that so emotionally kind of kind of wrecked by something in his life. Yeah. And you know, what we find is, Josh Brolin, he's just basically watching this ring footage of his son running away into the dark over and over and over again. Mm-hmm. He's obsessing about it. It's shown that it's causing a rift in his marriage, which I find, you know, kind of surprise. I mean, it's weird. Grief does weird things to people, because you think, like, wouldn't his wife understand why he's having a hard time with this? But she's processing it in her own way. Yeah. And this is a thing that happens with couples that lose children, is like they process it in different ways, and it can be really hard on the marriage. And I like that that's in the movie. I like that that's a little detail. He kind of spends his days going to the police station and asking the chief of police every day, any new developments, do you know anything new? And the chief of police kind of understands the situation that this father's in, but he has to kind of be like, listen, like, I keep telling you, we're doing everything we can, and as soon as we know something, we will let you know. You know, but it's kind of like Josh Brolin's just sort of like, well, I can't just sit here and let just wait, you know. So he's definitely doing a lot of his own research and work.
He's doing everything, and the police officer kind of puts him in his place. Like, we are doing everything. Like, what are you seeing that I'm not seeing? You know, I think it was a good scene.
Well, because he tells the chief of police, like, you need to look into that teacher. And he talks about her past. We learn a little bit more about Justine. He's like, she got fired from her last job because she was doing inappropriate things with a coworker. And it's like, and she has a history of substance abuse. And he's like, right, but like, she had a DUI. He's like, but none of that means that she kidnapped 17 kids. Like, that. That's not what that equals. And he's like, but it does show that she's a troubled person. You should be looking into her.
Yeah.
And then the guy just goes, what we know is those kids, nobody forced those kids to leave. They left of their own accord.
Yeah.
Like, so, like, I don't know how you're linking this to the teacher.
Yeah.
Like, those kids all got up on their own and walked out of those houses, you know?
And I like that scene. After this, he goes to his construction site because he owns a construction company, and he's messing up on everything. He ordered he didn't order the siding for the house. He ordered the wrong paint for the door, and he painted the color wrong, which it's supposed to be green, but it is red, the same color as the witch that was painted onto Justine's.
As he's going to get new paint, he sees Justine and he winds up following her home. And then I do like the way that Zach Krieger does this, and rather than like holding our hands and being like, let's now watch Josh Brolin's character paint the word witch on her car, the camera just shows us the red paint in the truck bed of his car, and we could and he just allows us to make that connection. And I'm like, good visual storytelling. Awesome. We can move on.
It's very clear that he was knocking on her door. He did the witch, like, that's it. Yeah.
Yeah. And he, at this point, his leading theory is that the teacher has something to do with it. He doesn't know what yet, but, we then get a dream sequence from Archer. Yes.
Yeah.
And Archer's dream sequence is, you know, he sort of watches his son run off into the distance, and he follows his son and tries to follow him. And this is something that, like, I had a friend ask me this. He was like, what's with the floating gun?
It basically
leads back to his house, and over his house, there's this giant floating, like,
AR-15
that says 217, like a digital clock on it. And it's like, I don't know. There's a lot of people that feel like this movie could be in some way commenting on gun violence in schools. Right.
And I think one of the elementary school shootings, there were 17 kids who were killed. And people are saying maybe it seems to be referencing gun violence or school shootings. It's never taken farther than this, I feel like. It's also, again, just a little part that it's showing that is kind of commentating on all of it. So
it's also just like dream logic. I kind of, I like that in the dream sequences in this movie, Zach Krieger doesn't try to trick us into thinking we're not in a dream. He lets us know we're in a dream. And so he just lets things happen that don't need to make sense because you know, so it's sort of like,
well, and it does go to the theme of weapons, right? I mean, the name of the movie is weapons.
Obviously, sure,
right? Yeah, but also, like, there's a big theme in this movie of using things as weapons. So Gladys is using the children as weapons. She uses her magic as weapons. There's also Julia Garner. She is using things as weapons for her, right? She also has, like, everyone is kind of parasites is also another thing. Everyone is kind of a parasite to someone else in this movie. So Justine is a parasite to Paul because she kind of latches onto him. And then Paul and Justine is also a, you know, she's a parasite with in the fact of her drug abuse or her alcohol abuse. Sorry. And, you know, the drug addict,
the drugs are parasitically changing.
Right. Yeah. Right. And so that's a huge theme. So the weapons, it shows the AR-15. I think it is making a commentary on gun violence or kind of attaching it.
It's maybe the most heavy-handed piece of imagery in the entire film. And I've heard a lot of people be like, that was a little, but I'm just kind of like, the way that I just kind of look at it and go, it's a dream sequence, you know?
Right.
Like, it's like,
I did think it was going to have more weight than it did.
Right.
But again, it's, you could take it any way you want, which is interesting.
But yeah, he goes into this dream house and he finds his son sleeping in his Batman bed, and his son's looking at him, but he won't talk to him. And he's asking him, where did you go? Where did you go? You know? And then,
he's talking about, he's sorry he never said it.
Right.
He's sorry that he never said, I love you more. Mm-hmm. Like he wanted to tell him so much, which goes into what you're talking about. This kind of like manly man who doesn't feel like he should show emotion.
Right.
And doesn't say that he doesn't feel like he should tell his kids he loves them, which is, you know, another commentary there. But Josh Brolin does such an amazing job. And it is it's a pretty like heart-wrenching scene.
Yeah. Yeah. It's very good. But then we get another Aunt Gladys dream jump scare. And again, we don't know who this is yet. It's just Pennywise the clown. And Matthew turns into this creepy clown lady who's in the bed and like screaming at Josh Brolin.
Yeah.
And this was a nice moment of like a jump scare, but then Josh Brolin wakes up in his son's bed, and then we have a nice like bit of comedy where he just goes, what the hell? He's like, what was that?
Yeah. Like, yeah. That was pretty great. It was pretty great.
And so, but then he sort of decides to like get to work. Like if the cops aren't going to do anything, I'm going to try to figure this thing out. And he's watching the Ring camera footage of the direction his son's heading. And then he's like, he's moving in this straight line. And so he tries to see if he can sort of map the trajectory of which way his son's heading using like a map of the neighborhood. And since he works in construction, makes sense that he might have that. And he finds another person who was reported to have Ring cam footage, and he goes to their house to see if he can kind of make like an intersecting line of where they both might have been heading. I found this weird too, that he goes and talks to the mom at this house, and he's like you're the only other person who had Ring cam footage, would you mind if I look? And she's like, yeah, I'm not comfortable with that. And I was like, this is one of those things where I'm like, really? You're not going to help this guy out? Both of your kids are missing and he's trying to do something about it. You're going to be like, no. But again, I think that this movie is talking about how grief affects different people in different ways.
And
then we get a little cameo from Justin Long here. And this was more of just a nod to Barbarian than it was anything else. It was just kind of like,
it was also kind of a comedic moment because
the
wife says no.
Yeah.
And then he waits for the husband and asks the husband, and the husband says yes.
Yeah. Like,
And
he uses, you know, but it's interesting that like this is the first time that Josh Brolin is made aware that the kids were running in the same way, in the same position. He sort of uses their video to like draw a straight line of where she might have been running. And then he kind of gets on the map and finds these intersecting points. And as he's heading to where the points might be intersecting in the neighborhood, he sees Julia Garner pull into a gas station, and he's like, you know what, I'm gonna go get her. And so he pulls up to her to yell at her, and they're arguing in this gas station. And I loved this. I love a good like middle of the day scare, where that comes out of nowhere, because they're just arguing and yelling at each other in this gas station, and all of a sudden she looks over his shoulder, and we just see Benedict Wong full on airplane running through this field,
blood all over his face. His eyes are like bulging out.
Yeah.
And he is like, again, like a torpedo. He is coming straight for her. And yeah. she's like, what, you know, she's like, Marcus, like,
yeah,
he hits. And do we see the full scene in this?
Oh yeah. He jumps on her and he's choking her, and Josh Brolin tries to pull him off, and she runs into gas station. And then he kicks him and he goes, stay down, you know? Yeah. And then he chases after her. And then I think we cut there, and I think that's the end of
right. Cause he runs, he tries to get him down. He tries to go to the gas station. Benedict Wong comes and they tackle each other. And then I think we cut to black, right? I think that's where we cut.
I think that's where we cut. And we go to
Paul.
Alden Ehrenreich, who is Paul. Yeah. And so now we're getting the police officer, Paul, finding out a little bit more about him. And we start with Paul out on...
He's in his locker room, right?
He's in the locker room and he's getting dressed, and he's about to start a shift. He gets a phone call from his girlfriend, who we know at this point he's cheated on with Julia Garner. But this is also what this information is telling us is that when he told Julia Garner that it's not really on right now with Dolores or whatever her name was, he was lying. Because it sounds very much like in this conversation with her that their relationship is very much so on. And it's also interesting because she's like, hey, maybe you should hit a meeting today. And he's like, I don't need to hit a meeting. I'm fine. So we know kind of through context clues. I like when in a thing that's structured like this, that the movie's telling us, oh, so he is in recovery for alcoholism.
Yeah.
He is supposed to be going to meetings, and this night where he meets up with Julia Garner, he's going to fall off the wagon.
Yeah. But yeah. It was great to kind of see that. He's like, well, you can tell that he's also very annoyed.
Yeah.
Like he's like, all right. Like if I feel like I need to go to a meeting, I'll go to a meeting. And so then it gives more context to the scene that we saw before. And you're like, oh, so he's in recovery, obviously, which we kind of figured before, but you kind of see the state of where he is.
Yeah, we also learned that the chief of police is his father-in-law.
Yeah.
His girlfriend's,
whatever it is. Yeah.
Fiance's dad. Yeah. And that they have dinner plans to celebrate his father-in-law's anniversary.
Yeah.
And he's like, oh, you know, we're going to have or lunch or dinner or something like that. And then he heads off for his shift and, you know, on his shift, he encounters Austin Abrams, who is the homeless guy that was opening the door for Julia Garner earlier in the film. Yeah. And he sees him trying to break into a building. And so he chases after him in his car. And while he's arresting him, he's, you know, does the thing that police officers say where he's like, hey, do you have anything sharp in your pockets that's going to stick me if I.
I don't want to get poked.
Yeah. And Austin Abrams is like, no, man, no. And he reaches into his pocket and he gets poked by the worst thing you can get poked by, which is a syringe. And he's so mad that he punches Austin Abrams in the face,
right in the face,
and knocks him out. And then he's like, oh, no, oh, no, because he realizes his dash cam caught that all on footage. And he's like, oh, no. So, you know, he like wakes him up and he's like, listen, you agree to just leave town and don't tell anybody about this, I'll let you go right now. Makes a deal with him. And then he has to go and like tell his father-in-law, like, hey, I got caught on my dash cam.
Yeah.
Punching this guy. And he's like, and he's like, listen, you keep your head down and that'll get scrubbed off of a server somewhere.
Like 30 days. Yeah.
Like, don't, you know, but it's definitely like a commentary on sort of like police and police brutality and like, you know, and surveillance states and things like that. And but also we're getting a real good look into the internal life of Paul. Like Paul doesn't seem like he enjoys his job and
he's obviously going through something right now. He's sober, but he doesn't seem to be happy.
Even like our first scene when we meet him, when he's drinking with Julia Garner and she says, why aren't you guys doing more to find the kids? And he goes, you know, I'm not a detective, right?
Yeah.
And it's like the way that he says it is kind of like, I'm just sort of like a beat cop who drives around in a patrol car. Like, I don't, you know, he's like, I'm just like, I think that he sort of just thinks of his life as kind of disappointing and not very interesting.
Yeah. And well, what I found interesting about this part at this point in the movie, it changes. The tone changes.
Yeah.
This is a much lighter, a much funnier section. Cause I mean, he punches him in the face pretty hard and you can, you know, obviously police brutality, all that stuff, but it's kind of played a little bit more for laughs. Cause the dude is like, he wakes up and he's like, dude, what? did you punch me in the face? And like,
yeah.
Like, and I actually
felt a lot of the stuff with Austin Abrams is pretty funny.
Yeah. Between Paul and the drug addict, this was a funny section. And these two people were like, I was very intrigued by this. But I think also this was a good point in the movie where Zach Cregger changes the tone. And it kept me more interested because I'm like, this isn't scary. This is funny.
Especially after how heightened the previous section ended.
Yes.
With like Marcus, like Naruto running with blood all over his face, tackling Julia Garner. And it's like so heightened to then shift into just sort of like the whole humdrum life of Paul and have it be kind of funny and have like the interaction between Paul and James be pretty comedic. Mm-hmm. And also the interactions between Paul and his father-in-law or whatever, his girlfriend's dad, be pretty funny. But yeah, Paul is like, he's had a bad day. And then we see him go meet up with Julia Garner at the bar, which we already know happened.
Yep.
And we do kind of like a funny, like smash cut to them hooking up and then him sort of being like hungover and heading home. And he gets busted by his fiance, girlfriend, whatever, because she was supposed to be out of town, but she comes home early. And this was something we missed earlier, but like during Julia Garner's section, there is a section where she goes into a liquor store and she's getting followed by like a woman wearing a red shirt. And we don't know who it is yet, but it's Paul's girlfriend or whoever. And she like throws Julia Garner on the ground and she's like, you made him drink and you. But so we find out how that all happened. But then we also see this kind of like funny moment where Paul like walks by the police chief who and the guy just like glares at him. And it's very, you know, like meet the parents or something, you know.
Well, and he is like he's worried and he's you can tell he's again still not having a good day.
Yeah.
And he goes out and he's like, hey, he sees Austin James.
Abrams,
and he's like, hey. Like, I told you to get out of here. So he jumps in his car. He unplugs his dash cam. And then I think this is when.
Right.
This is when we cut.
We go to Marcus.
Yes.
Yeah.
We
go to James.
We go to James.
And James is Austin Abrams. James is. And I will be honest. When it cut here and it went to James. And then we were at we were in the tent with the homeless guy. Initially, like my first gut reaction for some reason was like, I don't want to hang out with this guy. Like, I was like, what does this guy have to do with the movie?
Yes.
But actually, like this, I think the order of how he chooses to dole out the information is done very well structurally.
It is.
So we start off with just like James in a tent, and it's confirmed like James is definitely addicted to drugs.
Yeah. He's trying to light up. He's
scraping his crack pipe for just like the resin of, which by the way, again, this is all stuff that I've done, not with a crack pipe, but I have done this stuff with like a weed pipe where I've been like fiendishly scraping it for like any scraps of resin for, you know, like, so I definitely was like, oh yeah, man, I relate to this weird fiendish addict behavior.
Right.
But yeah, this section, like Austin Abrams is like, he holds this down in a really funny and engaging way. Like him walking around town and just like being on the phone with people while trying car doors really casually.
Yeah.
And stuff is, it's a thing
Yeah. He's talking to a family member. You can tell he's like, man, I got a job. I just got to pay mom back. Like I just got to pay mom back. And then I could pay you back. And like, again, this is like throughout the movie at this point, parasites have been referenced a couple times.
Yeah.
And I caught on to that and I was like, okay, so he is a parasite to his family.
Yeah.
He's, you know, trying to get money off of them for drugs. He really isn't better.
And like, the drugs are a parasite to him.
Exactly. Exactly.
Yeah.
So it's like, you know, I kind of had that thing too. Like, what is this guy going to add?
Yeah.
But it was actually, again, also kind of comedic and kind of funny. He's talking and then he does open one door and he's like, oh, and he jumps in the car and then he's like holding this little girl's backpack.
Yeah.
And he's
just walking down the street, talking on the phone while he's like dumping stuff out of her backpack. Yeah. And he finds like an iPad with headphones. Like a little,
it's like a Kindle, which is like.
Yeah. And I think it's funny, like him standing outside the pawn shop waiting for it to open and like chilling with like these like little girl headphones around his neck, you know, and he goes in there and tries to pawn this iPad, Kindle, whatever
it is,
and headphones. And the guy doesn't want it. He's like, just give me any. Give me $5.
Dude, worth $50, man, right? He said 40, 30, 10. And it's like he's trying to get whatever he can get out of it.
Yeah. And, you know, so
he's walking around. Well, I think at this point,
he goes to the house, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
Or does he get chased?
Or does he get chased first? Maybe he gets chased first.
I think he gets chased first. And we just kind of skim over that part. Cause we saw this with Paul.
Yeah. We like, know we how see this...
a little bit different angle, but
yeah, we know how it all unfolds, but
yeah,
he's desperate. And especially because if you're a drug addict who's addicted to crack and heroin, like mm-hmm. James is, you're going to have really, really painful, bad withdrawals if you don't get away, if you don't find a way to get drugs mm-hmm. fast. And we can see that with his character, that like, as the ticking clock is happening, he's like, I have to figure out a way to score fast. And he comes across Alex Gilley's house with all of the newspapers in the window. And this was a thing where I was like, this is kind of another little weird plot hole. Is what he notices is there's all these newspapers that have been delivered by the paperboy that haven't been collected, that are piled up on the driveway. Right. You know, like a telltale sign that the homeowners are not home. Right. But that's one of those things where I'm like, why would Aunt Gladys have not collected the newspapers? and what did she use to cover all the windows? Like, it doesn't make sense that Aunt Gladys would leave such an obvious sign.
Well, and why are they getting papers in the first place? This is a young couple that like would have no need in for the year, newspapers.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. So it's definitely one of those things where I'm like, that's a plot contrivance where it's like, this is how James decides that this house is probably empty right now.
Yeah.
And so James goes around the house, knocking on doors, looking just to check, you know, checking handles to see if he can break in. And he does. He successfully breaks into this house. And it's a very tense, but also funny scene where James is walking around this house and collecting things and looking for things to steal. And he, you know, basically takes a pillow out of a pillowcase and is walking around. He's, you know, but as he's doing this, like, he's looking at through like DVDs and VHS tapes, and in the reflection of the TV, he sees the two people that were sitting on the couch.
Yeah.
And he freaks out. He's like, oh, I'm so sorry. I didn't know anyone was here. I'm so sorry. But they're not moving.
Yeah.
And he walks up to them and he like waves his hand in front of their faces and like pokes them. And he's like, what the hell's going on? You know?
Yeah. Yeah.
But then, you know, as he's walking around this house, he opens up the door to the basement and walks down there. And
he like drops his stuff.
Yeah.
And then the parents stand up.
Yeah.
And he's like, isn't that what happens? Like he gets hit back and he falls down in the basement.
Somehow he winds up in the basement.
Yeah.
But I loved this reveal because this is like the mid movie.
This is
reveal.
The midpoint. Yeah.
Like James goes into the basement and there are all the kids.
Yeah.
And I was not expecting.
I
was not expecting at this point in the movie to be like, oh my gosh. Yeah. Like I was so shocked when he goes into the basement and he just sees 17 kids just standing there and they're not moving at all. They're just standing in the basement of this house.
And then all at once they turn around.
Oh yeah.
And they all look straight at him.
Yeah.
Which was like, oh my gosh. Like,
yeah.
And it was a great little scare.
He bails. He jets out of the house. And, you know, we see that he's taken some like cans of soup with him. We saw lots of cans of soup all over the house.
Yeah.
But he goes back to the pawn shop and he's able to get like $100 for all this silverware that he stole.
Yeah.
And he's able to like, you know, like get some drug money.
Yeah.
And
he sees a missing poster with all the kids and it says $50,000.
Yeah.
And he's like, oh, I know where these kids are. Like that's, so he calls the cops. And he's like, oh, I can't, can you just meet me at this house? Like, I don't trust the cops. And he has that phone conversation. And then he walks around and
they tell him he's got to come in. So he's like, So he's heading to the police station. And that's when Paul sees him. And that this is where Paul's story ended. But Paul's like, I told you to leave town.
Yeah.
So Paul chases him. And while Paul's chasing him, he runs into the woods where his tent is.
Yes.
And while he's in the woods, he feels like he's being watched and he's looking around. And this was like the most Pennywise Aunt Gladys ever gets.
Yeah.
Because we see Aunt Gladys out in the woods looking at him and like waving at him.
Yeah.
And she really looks like a scary clown. Jesus. And he's like, ah! And she's probably been following him because he was just in the house.
In the house.
And so, but so he runs to his tent and this part was, It was a very good, I was like, I felt like I could feel Zach Gregor doing a misdirect, that it's like he wants us to think it's at Gladys, but it's gonna be Paul. But I really didn't know. I was like,
I didn't know either.
Yeah. And so he grabs like three syringes and holds them in his hands. Like, whoever comes through this tent door, I'm going to stab him in the face. And it's Paul, and he stabs Paul in the face with three syringes. And it's just
Which was it was really funny, because you're scared. And then the release of tension is a laugh.
Well, and the fact that the car, Paul, basically handcuffs him, gets him in the back of his cruiser. But Paul's like, "Do you have AIDS?" And he's like, "What?" And he's like, "Do you have AIDS?"
Yeah.
It's like, I don't think so.
He's like, "Hepatitis, anything like that?" He's like, "Oh, I hope not."
I don't know.
And this also just is funny because Paul is going through so much crap.
Yeah.
He just got stabbed in the face.
Yeah.
Syringes
that
are obviously dirty.
Relapsed, his relationship's on the fritz. Paul's just having a terrible time. But Austin Abrams is like, "We gotta go to this house, dude. We gotta go." And so he takes him to the house where he saw the kids, and Paul gets out of the cruiser and Austin Abrams is like, "Hey man, you're not gonna take the reward for yourself, are you?" And he just looks at him and just walks away, and then he's like, "Oh man," he's just like, he's gonna get the money. But again, the door opens and this really particular way that the door to this house always opens, and it's like, again, it's just like, that's weird.
Yeah.
And then probably an hour later, out comes zombie Paul looking.
I wonder how long it was, because it seems like a lot.
It seems like actually middle a lot of
the day.
Yeah.
And then
yeah.
it's like nighttime.
Yeah.
And yeah.
And he comes out and he drags Austin Abrams into the house, and that's the end of James's storyline. And then we go to Marcus.
Yes.
And we've only got two left, but Marcus is Benedict Wong.
Yep.
And what we see is his side of the conversation, the phone conversation, when he was telling Julia Garner earlier in the film, you got to leave this kid alone.
Yeah.
And we see that it's like Marcus on the weekend, and he's just trying, him and his husband are just trying to prepare for a nice, quiet weekend at home.
Yeah. Which okay, this relationship is not in the movie that long at all. And I was like, this is the cutest relationship.
Yeah.
The husband just holds up things, and Benedict Wong points at it. Anyway, this was again, just great visual storytelling of they don't show this relationship at all, but I can tell these two people genuinely are in love and have this funny,
have been together for a long time.
Yeah. They have this weird, quirky relationship that I was like, this is so funny that I mean, at this relationship.
At one point, we see the meal that his husband has made for him, for them to sit down and watch TV on the weekend. And it's 7 hot dogs and a tray of chips and dip and carrots.
Yeah.
And that's it. And it's it's like what?
Yeah.
But a lot of people have talked about that. But I love little details that are it's like, this feels like a real relationship where this is just a thing where they have hot dog Saturday, where they sit down and they nosh on glizzies. And I was I was like, awesome. I'm down for it. But before that, he
this is the introduction of Gladys. Cause he's like, okay. Cause he tells Julia Garner, I will invite the parents in and I will talk to them. And the parents are supposed to come in at 2:00, and instead of the parents, it's Gladys, and we get the full view of Gladys, and she is overly nice and very strange. She's got this really bright red wig on with bad makeup that looks like a clown.
Yeah. And this is Amy Madigan, who was in a lot of things when we were growing up. She is Shanice in Uncle Buck. She is Kevin Costner's wife in Field of Dreams. And I have not seen Amy Madigan in years. And it is such an energetic and crazy and fierce performance from Amy Madigan. She eats this thing up and makes this so, unnerving and.
Well, she makes it work, because she's so, you have your guard down when she's talking, because she is so frail and small. They make her look really you could tell this is a wig, and it's a bad wig.
Yeah.
But she's like I said, overly nice. And then at points she changes, and she did an amazing job in making this character very scary and just very off-putting.
Yeah, and it's clear that Benedict Wong is like, he feels some type of way about her. He's just kind of like, I'd feel much more comfortable if I could talk to Alex's parents. And she's like, that won't be possible. And he's like, well, I kind of need to. He's like, he's like, if you're not the legal guardian, I have to talk to his parents. And because Benedict Wong is being too nosy, Gladys decides she's going to pay him and his husband a visit.
Yes.
And this is, you know, we get this scene of them at home on the weekend with the 7 hot dogs, and Gladys shows up and interrupts TV time. Yeah. And she says, oh, I missed my bus and I had to walk all the way here. And I'm so sorry. Could I come in and use your phone? And she walks in and, you know, she asks for a bowl of water.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it's like this very strange, idiosyncratic, weird thing.
And I love what she says too. She's like, it's she says, it's just a weird habit. I don't even try to justify it anymore.
Right.
And like, they're like, okay, they give her a bowl of water and it's full of water. And she takes out this black stick.
Mm-hmm.
And he's like, is that my ribbon or something?
From his office. He had these ribbons that she was looking at. Yeah.
And she wraps it around that. And then she goes up to the husband and she cuts off a piece of his hair. And
he's like, she just cut my hair. Like, I like this scene that he's just like, what? They're both like so confused. They both can't make sense. But it's interesting when moments like this happen where you think, why wouldn't someone just shut it down? But it's like, it's so weird and it's so bizarre. They don't know. And it's happening so fast that they don't know how to, and before they can really get a handle on the situation, she wraps the hair around this stick and breaks it.
Yeah.
And Benedict Wong turns into
this,
you know, just robot who tackles his husband and profusely vomits all of this black bile all over him and then proceeds to murder him.
Yeah. Which was,
It's pretty
graphic.
The gore in the movie from this point forward gets heavily escalated. Like, we are
the way that he kills his husband is like it's creepy and off-putting, but it doesn't show gratuitous gore. It's just the sounds and you can see what he's doing. And anyway, you're right. At this point, it gets much more graphic.
And it's kind of pedal to the metal from this point, because even though the movie has a lot more story left, we now know what it is. Like, this woman is a witch who does spells, and she somehow enchanted all of these kids. And for some reason, she has them all standing in the basement. We still don't really know why or what. But Benedict Wong takes off, and we have this really crazy sequence where he's running through the whole town.
Yeah.
And she's wrapped Julia Garner's hair around the wand that she got earlier. She breaks that. He heads to Julia Garner, tries to kill her. While he's in the process of doing that, she escapes with Josh Brolin's character, and they're driving away in his truck, and Benedict Wong is chasing after him.
Well, I think so. Julia Garner is in the gas station, and Josh Brolin knocks over Benedict Wong, but like, he cuts his arm, but Julia Garner gets away. And then Josh Brolin runs after Benedict Wong. He's running behind him. And then we see Wong gets nailed by a car, which I think is in the trailer. He gets hit by a car and obviously he's dead.
He is toast.
And it's like, at this point, Josh Brolin goes to the hospital. Like, you can see that he's giving a statement, and he walks out and he sees Julia Garner. And at this point, I was like, I was very interested, because they're both like, what is going on?
Like, well, and he tells her, he's like, listen, he's like, I've seen that style of running before and it's on these tapes. And he's like, I was going here. He's like, I found this map, and he's like, and I was going to head here. And Julia Garner looks at him and she goes, that's Alex Gilley's house.
Yeah.
And then we go to Alex. And so it's time for our final story, which is what's going on with Alex. And poor little Alex, he's got this loving mom and dad at home, and they tell him that their sick Aunt Gladys, mom's Aunt Gladys, is coming to stay because she's not doing well, and she needs to kind of lay low and stay at their house for a while.
And it was interesting. In the movie, it's presented as the mom's sister. They first say, well, your aunt has got to come, which is implied that it's his mom's sister. But I think the mom says that it's her aunt as well. So we don't really know what the relationship is directly. And we don't know, because they're both like, we haven't even seen her. Like, she didn't come to our wedding. Like, I don't even remember. Like, I don't even know who she is. And so it's like, we don't know who this is. And, you know, in a lot of things I saw online, it's like she could possibly be implanting memories into their minds so that she can live with them and that she can be there, because she could very well just be one of the sisters that's old, or she could have lived for thousands of years. We have no idea. I thought it was kind of interesting that they did that, of like, I have no idea how old this woman is or how she is connected to this family. But anyway, just kind of an interesting little thing that they add in there.
Yeah. But yeah, and I like that. I kind of like that we don't know the true origins of Aunt Gladys, or like what, like her, how she, you know.
Yeah.
I like that all of the characters in this film feel like they have a fuller life outside of the film.
Yes.
You know, like I think that's really interesting. Yeah, Aunt Gladys shows up, and within like the first day, she changes mom and dad into basically, you know, automatons. And Alex notices this when he gets home from school, that his parents are, they're not moving and they're not responding to him. And Aunt Gladys tells him, she's like, it's okay, they're just resting, you know, and his parents are sitting at the dining room table and they're not moving.
Yeah.
And so she goes, it's okay, they're just resting. And she goes, you can go up and, but he's kind of like, I think he's like asking questions, and she goes, you need to go to bed without supper. So he goes to bed, he wakes up in the morning, and his parents are still sitting in the exact same position they were in when he went to sleep. And she, I think when he gets home from school that day, she has him come and sit down at the table, and, or no, maybe it's before he leaves for school. She goes, Alex, why don't you come over here and sit down? And she has him sit down, and she goes, so, you know, I'm going to tell you something. She goes, you can't talk to anybody at school about what's going on. She's like, because, she's like, if you do, this will happen. And she breaks the, this part's crazy. And this is like, they show this quickly in the trailer, but I had no idea what the context for it was. And this really still caught me off. I mean, it's very jarring.
It is
very upsetting to watch this happen, but the parents both pick up forks and they just start jamming themselves in the face with these forks over and over and over again. And then Alex is begging, like, please stop, tell him to stop. Yeah. No. And she stops and she's like, so just so you know, I can do that anytime I want.
Yeah.
And I will make them do that if you tell anyone about what's going on here. Yeah. And again, this is like where like the movie is a pretty strong allegory for child abuse, for what happens with child sexual abuse or child physical abuse, where like an adult basically holds this kind of emotional leverage over a kid and is like, here's why you can't tell anyone what's going on, because I'll hurt people you care about or hurt you even more if you do.
Yeah.
And so Alex basically is going to school really depressed, and you know, he comes home and he's told by his aunt that he has to feed his parents soup, and he's feeding them all these, and she makes him go to the store and get the soup, and he's got to feed his mom and dad soup. And it's, you know, it's all just like really sad and disturbing.
Yeah.
And
she says at one point, she's like, listen, I thought your parents would make me better, but they won't. And she's like, I need something else. And she makes him get all the kids.
Yeah.
So he steals like their little nameplates that they have, and he brings them home, and she says, you know, I need something to keep living, because Alex just wants to save his parents.
I also thought that it was interesting that nobody noticed that the nameplates were missing off of all the kids' copies.
Yeah.
Another one of those things where I was like, oh, I thought you'd think that that would be something that someone at the school would be like, didn't they used to have, you know, like, I don't know.
Yeah. Yeah. And so, but he brings them all home, and then she, at 2:17, she does this little spell.
I did like this sequence of seeing it from their perspective seeing all these kids running down their street and running. And I thought that was pretty cool to kind of see it happening. And again, like, it's cinematically effective enough for me to not get caught up in thinking about the, wouldn't people have seen this, or, you know,
And it was, I mean, it, this is another thing too, that I was so interested, but it doesn't get into, Gladys that much. Like, She is a parasite. She is feeding off the life force of these people, right? And she's then feeding off the life force of the kids. And it is keeping her young. It's keeping her alive. But that's really like as deep as they go. We don't know how she does that. We don't know how all of this is happening. But it, again, it's still so intriguing and engaging that I'm like, I just want to know what happens. So we see all the kids are there and he has to feed them soup. And, she is still like, you know, everything at this point, we know that that's, you know, she's like, you have got to go to the school and you can't say anything. Like you can't, you know, I'll do this to your parents again. And then we see in the beginning that Gladys is there with the dad. And she said, oh, this is, you know, this is Alex's dad, but he had a stroke, so he can't speak.
Right.
And the FBI come to the house and she had the kids just go in the backyard, which was kind of like, nobody saw that like in the middle of the day.
Right. Right.
But she hides the kids away, so they're not in the basement. The FBI searches the house and they kind of just like take her off the list. And she could have been doing something to them. We don't know.
Yeah.
But then that's really kind of,
And then we're heading into our kind of the finale of the movie, which is that Archer and Justine show up at the house.
Yeah.
And I really like this, that they walk into the house and they're walking around. There's no noise. You know, they can't. It's very creepy. But Archer notices these lines of salt that are all around the house.
Yeah. And before that, even Gladys tells Alex, we have to leave. Like, we can't be here. We have to go. People are sniffing us out. And then she walks into her room and she says, don't pass the salt line. And we see that the parents are like guarding the room and there's a salt line right in front of them.
Yeah.
And then we see them and they see all these salt lines. When Josh Brolin and Julia Garner come in, they see these salt lines and they're like, what is going on?
Yeah, but once he notices that, he's like, wait, don't move. Yeah. And she steps over the line and zombie Paul comes alive and starts chasing her. Zombie James starts chasing Josh Brolin. There's this really funny thing between Josh Brolin and Zombie James where he keeps picking him up and throwing him. And every time he throws him, like, James just gets back up and goes, he's like, and just keeps chasing him. And he just keeps grabbing him and throwing him. And I just really liked the construction of this whole finale. It was really, really fun. And the chase between Julia Garner and Paul in the kitchen was kind of effective because of their relationship. And I, you know, him sort of pushing through the pain of her, like stabbing him in the hand and like, she's grating pieces of his face off with a potato peeler. Yeah. And Alex upstairs decides to like test the boundaries of this salt line. And he puts one toe over the salt line and his parents chase him.
Yeah.
It was like, I was definitely getting, you know, Kubrick vibes of like,
yes,
parents punching through the door.
Yep.
Like Jack Nicholson in The Shining.
Yeah. And that's in the trailer. You see the mom, she looks like a zombie. And I kind of feel like this was a part of Alex's plan because he saw them coming.
Yeah.
He gets his parents to kind of come in his room and he's got a Jack and Jill bathroom and he kind of goes out back in. And then he goes into the room where Gladys was and then Josh Brolin goes downstairs and he sees that, like, he sees all the kids and he's like, he's looking for Matthew. And then Gladys is down there and she grabs something from him.
It's a pretty scary jump scare too.
It is. Yeah.
It's like Josh Brolin walking around with his iPhone light and all of a sudden terrifying Amy Madigan comes out of the darkness and jumps at him. And boy, that was scary.
She
takes something off of him. She, you know, she's going to turn him into a zombie now too.
Yeah. Well, Julia and Justine is fighting Paul. She gets a hold of his gun and she ends up killing him, which was pretty effective. I mean, as far as emotionally, it was like, oh my gosh.
Yeah.
Like,
and then she kills Austin Abram too.
Yeah, she does.
Abrams. Yeah.
Yeah.
With the same way. Cause he's sort of Josh Brolin's wrestling with him.
That's right.
But then Aunt Gladys turns Josh Brolin against Julia Garner. And so Josh Brolin is turned against her. And then Gladys comes out and sort of reveals herself that, like, she's the puppeteer behind all of this. Mm-hmm. But while this is happening, Alex is upstairs and he's gotten Aunt Gladys out of her room, and he's kind of run a loop back into her room and grabbed her head that her wig usually sits on.
Yeah. And he grabs the tree that she's been, this black tree that she's been using that has all the twigs on it.
Yeah. And he takes a twig and he wraps her hair around a twig and he pricks his finger and puts his blood on it.
Cause Gladys has shown this all to Alex throughout the whole movie. Like, she's showing him kind of how she does it.
Yeah.
Which was very interesting. So he knows what to do. So he does that.
Yeah.
And then he snaps. Okay.
This is great.
How did you feel about this scene? Cause what happens? He snaps the twig. All the kids snap out and they start, and Gladys knows that something.
She knows immediately when it snaps. It's almost like she can feel it in her soul. And she just goes, oh no.
Yeah.
And she runs out the front door. And I really like that Zach Krieger chooses to play this comedically.
Oh yeah.
Like that he just lets it be fun, but it's also like very cathartic for these kids who have been through a lot and who we find out by the end of the movie, it kind of seems like suffer lifelong damage from what was done, trauma and damage from what happened to them. But basically the kids, the 17 weapons, chase her through the neighborhood. And we just have this funny scene of like this old lady running around being like, ah, help! Yeah. And like 17 screaming kids just being like, ah, like chasing her.
And she runs through a house. And the people are like, what the heck? And then the 17 kids like jump through the windows and like are just running and jumping through. And it was
I love this POV camera shot where it's right on the head of one of the girls.
Yeah.
And it's like Gladys like goes through a door and closes it behind her. And the door has a glass frame and the girl just runs through the glass and it's just like, and then like jumps through a window and jumps on her back and tackles her. And it's like, I loved that like POV shot. But once these kids get a hold of her, they just rip her apart.
Literally
just rip her limb from limb.
Yeah. And some of the kids have their thumbs in her eyes.
Yeah.
And like they pull on her and they pull her face from her jaw. Yeah. And you see her leg has been pulled off.
Yeah.
And
they're
just like biting her fingers.
Yeah. It's pretty gnarly. It's pretty good.
And all this time, Josh Brolin is choking Julia Garner.
Yeah.
But
once the main witch is dead, kind of like in the movie Witches, it's like, once Gladys is dead, the spell is more or less broken.
Yep.
So mom and dad become docile again. And Josh Brolin snaps out of his trance.
Yeah.
He follows the trail of blood and mayhem to find the kids. He finds his son, Matthew, and picks him up.
And his son is just totally blank.
Yeah.
Like not there.
And Julia Garner goes upstairs to find Alex hugging his parents, but his parents, even though they're calm, they're, you know, and it basically, the narration says that Alex's parents continued to have people feed them soup, just not other people. So it's suggested that they never fully recover. They have to live in a facility where they're basically fed.
Yeah.
The narration also says most of the kids never returned to talking, which again goes to that thing of like, they never fully came back, but it's like, but some kids recently have started talking again.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it sort of suggested that like maybe some of these kids might come back slowly but surely,
right? Yeah,
with enough time.
Yeah. And I mean, Josh Brolin was under the spell for just a few minutes.
Yeah. So
and so it's kind of suggested that like if you you know, if you were under the spell for an extended period of time, it's obviously done a ton of damage. So he is fine, but everybody else is not fine. And it ends there. I mean, that's
weapons.
And it's that. I mean, it says Alex has to live with a different aunt who is much nicer, which I was like, man, that is so sad.
Yeah, it's very sad. Like the ending as like we get that moment of sort of like humor and catharsis with the kids chasing Gladys and ripping her apart. But then the ending is still kind of like, oh, bummer. Yeah.
It is
like, oh, like all these kids are like permanently altered by this. But I think that that's right. It's like it should have.
Yeah.
The events of the film should have some kind of lasting consequence.
They should.
And I'm glad that they do. But that's weapons. So that's the movie. Let's get into our scores. If this is your first time watching our show, we give scores out of 10, 10 being the best. We give a score for technical rating being the technical craft of the film, the writing, the editing, the acting, all of that good stuff. We give a score for the ending. How well did they stick the landing? How well did they wrap things up? We give a score for rewatchability. We give a score for cultural significance and impact. And we give a score for our subjective feelings about the film. So Kramer, what is your technical rating for Weapons?
My technical rating, I'm giving an 8. I mean, the movie was just, for all of its flaws that we have talked about, again, like, it is so entertaining. And it was the way that they told it from multiple perspectives and how it all unfolds. And then just also the direction of, like, it is scary. It is funny. It is all these different things. Like, I'm amazed that it was so engaging, and I just had a lot of fun. And I think also that's a huge technical achievement. I'm docking too because of the thing, when you do break it down, there are things that don't hold up, but also it's kind of intentional that way. So I gave it an 8.
Yeah, so technically I gave Weapons a 9. Like I said, at the end of the movie, I was like, I don't know how I'm not going to give this a 10. I just was like, what am I going to dock it points for? Because I just was kind of like, everything he wanted to do, I feel like he executed so well.
Yes.
At the level of just the pure craft of the filmmaking. I just felt like the structure of the screenplay worked. I felt like the detail of all the characters was so rich and so well drawn.
Yes.
I felt like the performances were all really well executed. The effects were all really well executed. The cinematography was really, really good at evoking whatever emotion it needed to evoke in all these different sections. And yeah, I could get nitpicky about some of those things that we've talked about. But again, I feel like those things exist in almost every single movie.
Oh, yeah.
And my question usually with those things is like, were they bad enough that they distracted me from being able to enjoy the film? And for the most part in this movie, the answer is no.
Right.
But I still look at it and go, I do think that there's so many of them that like, he maybe could have had, like, I think that maybe there could have been one or two more cleaning passes on the script just to tighten up a few of those questions.
Right.
Or a few of those maybe plot contrivances, and make it even a little bit cleaner, but it's pretty, the execution works, you know? So I give it a 9, and I'm just docking it a point for those reasons.
I think it's valid.
How about the ending?
The ending, I gave an 8. It's pulled off extremely well. And it was kind of a shock of like how funny it was.
Yeah.
And I'm just kind of docking it for like looking back. It's like, okay, I do wish I would know a little bit more about Gladys, like what is going on, but it didn't take away from my enjoyment. So it was a good, satisfying ending. So gave it another 8.
Yeah, I gave it a 9. Like when this movie hit the end title and it was like Weapons, when it was over, I just turned to my girlfriend. I was like, that movie rules. I just felt like it was such a satisfying structure and such a satisfying buildup and conclusion. And again, it's like these mystery box questions. They're never going to have the coolest possible answer, but I think it's a cooler answer than like aliens or I don't know. I actually think the reveal that it's like an evil aunt who's a witch is kind of fun and unexpected. And I felt like it was handled quite well by the material, you know, like I feel like the filmmaking handles it quite well. And then the way that they decide to build it all up and pay it all off at the end was like, that was pretty darn satisfying. Pretty happy with the conclusion of the film. Didn't feel robbed or, you know, misled or lied to or cheated out of anything. I felt very satisfied. So how about the rewatchability of this film?
Rewatchability, I gave a 9 because it was just a fun movie to watch. And I feel like it's great to see it in the theater with a bunch of people where you can really like feed off that energy. But I also think like watching it at home, it would be really, really fun too. Like you're going to get a lot out of this movie. And I think it is, upon rewatch, you could pick up new things and kind of take new, you know, views of it and things like that. So it is very, I find it very rewatchable.
I gave it a 9 as well. I think that because there's so much going on with all of these different characters, I would not be surprised at all if this is the kind of movie that continues to surprise me with successive viewings. Like, this is a completely non sequitur, but I watched the movie Seven the other night because Olivia had never seen it before.
Ooh.
And so we watched it, and in the one of the first shots of Gwyneth Paltrow in the movie is she's looking through a window at a glass pane at Brad Pitt, and it's a box, and her head is in the box. And I was like, what? And I said out loud, I go, oh my God. And she goes, what? And I go, nothing.
You'll find out later.
I can't tell you. And she's like, what? She's like, what? And I was like, it's just something I just noticed that I've never noticed before. Yeah. And I love that. When I've probably seen Seven.
Yeah.
10 to 15 times in my life. And not only is it that one shot, he does it several times in the movie. He frames her head in boxes.
Oh,
and I was like, it's crazy that he does it, like that I'd never noticed it before. And I feel like Weapons just might be one of those movies that the more I watch it, as the years go on, going to see more and more things where I go, oh geez, that's really interesting. Cause it does seem like a movie that has a lot of details in it like that. So, how about cultural impact and significance?
Cultural impact, I'm giving an 8. I think, we'll see how this film holds up, in the long run, but I mean, people are seeing it and people are talking about it. And I think that it is a fresh take on something, which is really good. And I think it'll inspire a lot of people down the line as well. So I think it's pretty good.
I gave it an 8 as well. I feel like this is another nice feather in the cap of the directing career of Zach Cregger. And I'm interested to see where he goes next. I wonder if he's going to sort of pigeonhole himself as like a horror director who sort of does genre bendy horror films that have twists and turns and have some good laughs, or if he'll try to do more like Ari Aster and completely pivot into a different direction of who knows. I'm curious to see what happens next, but I definitely think that people are taking notice of him if they weren't already after Barbarian.
Yes.
And what is your subjective score?
My subjective score is an 8. Had a ton of fun, really liked it. But those nitpick things, I am worried that on rewatch they will come back and make it a little bit more frustrating. But also I just enjoyed the movie. It was a great time. So I think people should go see it.
Yeah. I gave it a 9. It's one of my top movies of the year so far. I agree with all of the nitpicks and I see them all. Yeah. And I just am still like, I don't know, the movie's awesome. It's just like cool. It's got a lot going for it. It's a lot of fun. Go see it in the theater if you haven't already. And if you watched this before seeing it, boy, you ruined a really great movie for yourself.
Yeah, you did.
But still go see it and see what you think. All right. Let us know in the comments. Did you see Weapons? Do you agree with us? Do you disagree with us? Why? Why not? Like, share, comment, subscribe. If you want to keep up with the show, we are going to be watching, unfortunately, the new War of the Worlds movie. I think it just came out on Amazon. The Ice Cube War of the Worlds movie, not the Steven Spielberg, the much better Steven Spielberg, Tom Cruise movie.
Yes.
This movie is getting a lot of buzz for just how incredibly bad it is.
Yeah.
And we will be covering that next. And we might just have a few people who actually worked on the film join us to give us some insights into the making of a really terrible movie. So if you want to follow along, watch at your own peril War of the Worlds on Amazon starring Ice Cube, and that's what we'll be covering next week, and we'll see you then.